You're listening to Rosie on the House.
On this beautiful Arizona Saturday morning, welcome to Rosie on the House. If you're just joining us, this is the second hour of our weekly radio broadcast. Not all of our affiliates carry our new 7 o'clock hour yet, but this 8 o'clock hour we designate to outdoor living. And each Saturday of the month, we bring in a different specialist from agriculture, from arboriculture, from nursery and urban farming. And four times a year, we have this magic month where we have five Saturdays that we save for interesting interviews. And this Saturday, our topic was spawned off an article I read in Arizona Wildlife Views, which is a publication the Arizona Game and Fish puts out on a bi-monthly basis. It's a magazine you can subscribe to. And this was from September and October of this month. And it was Foraging for Feasts, all about how the native Indians survived on the native plants that grow right here in the desert. And I thought, well, you know, I have seen where people have fried the paddle of a prickly pear cactus and eat it. We've made prickly pear jelly ourselves. I have licked Mormon tea out of curiosity, and I went right back to my traditional iceberg lettuce after that. And it was a very interesting article. And for this Saturday, we brought one of the authors that was mentioned in the article, Carolyn Neathammer, who's written over 10 books on this topic of how people survived eating cactus, Mormon tea, sagebrush for thousands of years, things we don't even consider in our diet today. And we've got her on the line now joining us from Tucson. Welcome, Carolyn. And if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. You can text questions to 411-923 or email us at info@rosieonthehouse.com. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us about the titles of the books you've published. Just run through them real quick.
Well, all of my books have not been on edible wild plants, but many of them have. The very first book I did was called American Indian Food and Lore. It's been republished and retitled as American Indian Cooking. And in that one, I was just a kid, and I traveled around the arid Southwest talking to Native Indian women about how they used the edible wild plants. It was more or less how their grandmothers used them. And because I did the work in the early 70s, that was a good time to do it because I talked to middle-aged women who remembered working and gathering with their grandmas. So that really took our knowledge back almost to the turn of the last century. So that was very interesting. Now, the recipes that are in there are pretty basic because they didn't have fancy cooking techniques. But it's interesting. And even if you didn't want to cook those things, if you were taking a hike and you saw those plants, then it was more meaningful to you. You could say, oh, there's a mesquite tree. Well, we could use those pods for food, and that sap made a good hair dye, and on and on. Later on, maybe 7 or 8 years later, I did another book called The Tumbleweed Gourmet, which was more modern recipes for edible wild plants. Then a few years went by, and I did a book called The Prickly Pear Cookbook, and that's all about various uses for both the fruit and the pads. I heard you in your introduction talk about the cooking of the pads. Then more recently, I've done a book called Cooking the Wild Southwest, and I bring that down to 23 edible wild plants that grow in Arizona that are easy to recognize. You're not going to poison yourself by confusing it with something else. They're easy to gather, and they taste good. So that pretty much covers that particular part of my book writing.
And in all of that research and in all the different books, has there ever been an edible application for just a plain creosote bush?
A what bush?
Creosote, the greasewoods.
You know, that's more of a medicinal. It tastes nasty. But there are, I am not an expert on medicinal plants, but that's for somebody else. But creosote tea, I think that they use it for something, but that's not my line.
Okay.
Although I must say that some of the young cooks and chefs who are beginning to use edible wild plants in, like, the restaurants and so forth, will gather some of the flowers and sprinkle them on, say, granola. I just interviewed a chef who did that recently. And some gather the tight buds and pickle them, and they're almost like a caper.
Interesting. I was really just curious, not for medicinal reasons, but there's so many creosote when you get into the undisturbed flatlands of the desert. What could we use?
Yeah, it would be better if it tasted better, wouldn't it? Because it's so ubiquitous. But we got prickly pears, and so, I mean, they're everywhere.
Well, go through a couple of the ones you specialize in. You say there's 23 that people would recognize, and for anyone that doesn't know the story, Phoenix was actually almost named Pumpkinville because when the travelers got here, there were so many wild pumpkins just growing along the riverbed left over from the Indian tribes.
Oh, interesting. Well, yes, of course, the agriculture that the Native Americans did in that area along the Gila before it was dammed up was profound. There are stories about when the soldiers from the Civil War came through, the Native Americans living along that area were able to supply them with huge amounts of pumpkins and melons and wheat. And they were fabulous, fabulous farmers. It wasn't actually a wild plant. It was probably just, you know, the seeds left over from pumpkins left behind because there were just so many.
So what are some of the native ones? We've got the mesquite flower bean that I think our listeners of this hour are probably familiar with. You'd mentioned prickly pear.
Well, if you start out in the early part of the year, there's the wild greens, and they'll come along stream beds or creeks as early as late February, early March. And if you're taking a little hike along, you can look under the shelves or the ledges, and they kind of grow in the shade. And then one of the next things are when the prickly pear send out their new pads. You can't just go out in the desert any old time and whack off a prickly pear pad and eat it, because once they get mature, they get that inner structure that's very woody. So it's only the brand new pads that can be gathered. And it's better to do that Mexican kind that you tend to find in yards. You don't find them out on the desert. They're the tastiest, and they have many more fewer stickers. But everything is edible, and it just kind of depends on how hungry you are. Then later on, next will come saguaro fruits, of course. They were very, very important to the Indians throughout southern Arizona. And as a matter of fact, that was the beginning of their year, was the saguaro harvest. They would go out into the fields, leave their villages, and gather the saguaro fruits using the long pole. Some wine, just a little bit, and it wasn't very alcoholic. And they would dry the fruit and the seeds to use throughout the year. About that same time, of course, that was very difficult. It was really, really hot. And anybody who's lived during that part of Arizona summer knows you just can't wait for the rains to come and cool it off. And so they did have a rain ceremony that was involved with the saguaro wine.
And
then
that's
next,
a state
about the
flower.
Same time were the mesquite pod. And let's see, it was probably maybe about 20 years ago. Concurrently, several people got the idea that you could grind mesquite pods with a hammer mill, which is a very common piece of agricultural equipment, and make this fine mesquite meal. Previous to that, I worked with a couple of Tohono O'odham women, and they were teaching me about mesquite flour. And even then, I mean, there was hardly anybody, there were no Tohono O'odham even using mesquite meal because it was so doggone hard to produce it. And nobody wants to grind with a matake anymore. But once we were able to get this beautiful mesquite meal with practically no effort, all you have to do is go gather them and then show up someplace where they're milling and get your mesquite meal, it became a lot more reasonable for people to use it and start inventing recipes with it. Then, after that, come late August, September, October, we have prickly pear fruits, which are so easy to gather.
And Carolyn, we're going to stop right there. We've got to come to a break.
Used in so many wonderful ways.
We're going to come to a break real quick, Carolyn. We'll come back right after this. We're talking with Carolyn Neathammer. She's the author of The American Indian Cooking. And in it, she states that scientists estimate that the Sonoran Desert alone supplied indigenous people with close to 400 non-cultivated plants. More here with Carolyn at Rosie on the House right after this.